with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! If the audio sounds a little funny to you, that's because it's a little funny on this end, too. Oh, dear. The streaming PC dropped dead this morning, last night, sometime. And I've been subbing in another computer, and it doesn't—it's apparently not sounding particularly good. Texas Betsy and Sparky and Bobby and Jan are in the chat room, and they're giving me a little bit of feedback on how things are. Ah. Well, like I said a few minutes ago, at least I know I've got something to keep me busy this weekend. Jeremy noting, yeah, audio's a tad off. Not too bad, though. Okay, let's just see how this all plays out. Okay, don't touch which... the music is gone, so we'll see how the voice is going. Welcome to Thorn in the Side Thursday. Ever so apropos, as far as I can tell. For pity's sakes. Thorn in the Side Thursday, this 23rd day of January 2014. And sounds like I'm in a cave. Yeah, I know. It's kind of weird, isn't it? No, that's me in a cave. I don't like sounding like I'm coming from the bottom of a barrel. But what's going on is I'm running into the onboard sound card of one of the laptops, and you know, this onboard sound of a laptop is never anything that's particularly impressive. So that probably accounts for it. Had a much nicer sound card on the computer that just bailed on me. Sheesh. So anyway, 4 minutes past the hour. So what a way to start a program out here on the cutting edge of technology. Ha 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 ha, Isaac. Sounds like you're using a Radio Shack mic. By God, this is the vaunted Electra Voice RE20, the broadcast standard for these things. And no, it's not this equipment. It's the craptastic sound card inside the streaming laptop now. Ugh. So we'll find a way to get through this. There's going to be a little bit of a program break this evening, along about 6:30. Well, about 6:30, I'm going to be doing a quick interview with Sandy Leon Vest over on PRN. I'm looking forward to the conversation. And should be quite fun. So I don't know. We'll try to maybe we'll keep the stream open or not, depending on how that has to play out. That comes around at Texas Tea. Replace a tube, Bob. Okay. Because it's a series of tubes, you know. It's not a big truck. Yeah, GK noting, maybe it's time for some new baling wire and duct tape. Yeah, don't forget the tennis balls. There has been screaming. But I think we'll have plenty to talk about this evening. It'll just take some finagling around to square up some of the audio issues. Hopefully that'll be taken care of. You know, I'll get that taken care of over the weekend. It might be something as little as changing out the batteries on the motherboard. Or it could be that the Knutton valve is completely disconnected from the flageolet, in which case I'm really screwed. Oh, thanks, Jeremy. You sound like you're the local weatherman calling in on a phone from the local state fair. Hopefully we'll get through this. It is. Oh, Lord, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday here. And we've got a whole bunch of snow on the ground outside. More coming. The Horn Studio is a toasty 62 degrees. My feet feel great. Just wonderful. What are we expecting tonight? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, it's apparently 10 right now here. On our way down to 1. The forecast calls for a high of 12 this coming Tuesday and a low of 1. That's changed, I guess, because a few minutes ago, the high was 9 and the low was 9 below. I was real excited about that. There's no sense carping about it. It's just a matter of figuring out a way to get used to it. Or riding it through. Just as long as everybody stays safe, right? And, by the way, good news, we actually start $30 to the good this evening, thanks to Dan and Beth's and Randy's and Anthony's and Ace's and, who did I miss? Help last night. That means we only need to raise $120 this evening, which hopefully we will do, unless there's something so off-putting about sounding like one is in the bottom of a barrel that we don't. I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted. I'm trying to keep an eye on the levels over here on the streaming interface, and they look like they're okay, but who knows. Wait a minute. I wonder if that's going to make any difference. It's like all the high ends got. Well, yeah, why get lost in? Now, this is what happens when you don't have an engineering and producing and call screening and. It can get a little chaotic. You know, last night was, of course, prayer meeting Wednesday. And I let a story blow by the boards that I'm kind of ashamed of myself for missing. Because you don't get these just every day. And it's kind of nearly almost sort of local. It takes place across the river in Kentuckistan. A little community, you can go there via Interstate 64, a little community called Olive Hill. Doesn't that just sound charming? Charming little place? And there in Olive Hill, or the general area, there is a house of worship, the Perry's Branch Holiness Tabernacle Church. Now, you can just imagine what went on at the Perry's Branch Holiness Tabernacle Church. No, you can't. Or maybe you can. If you're working for the Silver Lining Committee, I can say that at least in this story, no children were sexually abused. Of course, the Perry's Branch Holiness Tabernacle Church was one of those tax-exempt institutions that we give a big chunk of the commons to because they're taking care of some of our souls, even if they don't exist. The Perry's Branch Holiness Holiness Tabernacle Church was, you know, one of those points of intercession with the all-loving creator of the universe. It took about a year. Investigators to take down what they described as one of the largest pill trafficking operations in Kentucky. The FADE Drug Task Force announced that in this bust, which was called Operation Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, the agents seized more than $1 million in cash and assets and tens of thousands of pain narcotic pills. $1 million in cash and assets and tens of thousands of pills carrying a street value of $40 to $45 per pill. The bust went down back in 2013. Yesterday, the pastor of the Perry's Branch Holiness Tabernacle Church pled guilty. To a number of federal drug charges. Good God. It was a multi-million dollar trafficking organization being headed by a pastor working under the rubric of the Prince of Peace. You know, when one of these things happen, just based on the statistics of scale, you have to wonder, how many more of these things are there? Pill mills for Jesus. I'm surprised they didn't think of it sooner. Imagine that. A region, and that's part of eastern Kentucky, a region that is absolutely burned up with these Rush Limbaugh medications. And the folks out there who are telling, who are trying to bring people to the loving peace that passeth all understanding of Christ Jesus are the ones moving the dope. Kind of puts a new spin on that whole business of Karl Marx referring to religion as the opiate of the masses, doesn't it? Opiate indeed. This let's see, conspiracy to distribute oxycodone, possession of oxycodone with intent to distribute. Just amazing. I mean, this is kind of Breaking Bad stuff, isn't it? What would you call this? Breaking God? Mm-hmm. By the way, from the Silver Linings Department, Dr. John noting, here's something about living through the Polar Vortex, the sequel. It's a great chance to try frost distilling. Not that anyone will, of course, Agent Fred. That's just a speculative, hypothetical observation. Thank you, Rob, in Minnesota, noting, audio's slightly off, Bob, but definitely listenable on my end. Wolverines! Freedom! Yeah, freedom's just another word for no pills left to take. At least down in Olive Hill at the Perry's Branch Apostolic Holy Tabernacle Church Temple Herpetological Sanctuary. But, you know, when you set up a national scam where anybody who says that they're talking to their invisible friend gets to operate tax-free, somebody's finally going to figure out that that's a nice little dodge. Actually, a lot of somebodies have already figured out it's a nice little dodge. Marion Robertson? Yeah, Marion. Yeah, I know. Liquor supply officer. Sea of Galilee mud mask. But now we have a new low bar by which we can judge the religion industry. At least they weren't hustling dope. That is a mighty low bar, isn't it? And apparently there's a great, humongous interstate migration going on. I didn't know she was still breathing out and breathing in again. But lo and behold, check out, via our friends at Right Wing Watch, check out Phyllis Schlafly. Schlafly.
The Jersey court ruled that because the U.S. Supreme Court recently ordered federal benefits be granted to same-sex couples who are married under state law, the civil union law in New Jersey was inadequate to ensure that homosexual couples in New Jersey are able to receive the same benefits as married couples. There was no dissent from the New Jersey court's ruling, not even by Governor Christie's own judicial appointments. But many Americans are dissenting with their feet by moving away from the same-sex marriage states and into the many states that continue to recognize the value of marriage as between only one man and one woman.
Right, and whoever else that they decide to go a-romping around with. I think I liked Phyllis Schlafly better when she sounded, well, I prefer my Katharine Hepburn straight, no chaser. By that I mean, ooh, doesn't she just sound icky, Phyllis Schlafly? But do you notice that? There's a great out-migration away from those gay marrying states to go and live in states that have higher divorce rates than the gay marriage states, that have higher teen pregnancy rates. Many people are moving to many states. Many, many. For those of you who recall the Police Academy movies. Many, many. How many's in a many, Phyllis? It's got to be more than two, right? Just by definition of the word. I bet you Phyllis can't find two. Or is she counting in that family that went floating away from Arizona a few months back and were found bobbing in the middle of the Pacific? Oh, Jesus. What a bunch of winners. But it really wouldn't be Thorn in the Side Thursday. Honest to Pete, it wouldn't. It wouldn't be Thorn in the Side Thursday without taking note of Mike Huckstraby, former governor of the state of Arkansas, who took to the podium, to explain to the Republican National Committee, American women need to be mansplained a little more often, don't they? Sure they do. Because nobody understands the inner workings of a woman's reproductive system better than a Baptist minister, former governor of Arkansas.
Democrats think that women are nothing more than helpless and hopeless creatures whose only goal in life is to have the government provide for them birth control medication. Women I know are smart, educated, intelligent, capable of doing anything that anyone else can do. Our party stands for the recognition of the equality of women and the capacity of women. That's not a war on them. It's a war for them.
Lady people, in working tirelessly to make sure that pasty-faced, doughy old white men have control of the workings of your reproductive systems, we're waging a war for you. Because we're not like those damn Democrats who think that all in the world... Really, did you catch that? Liberals, progressives, Democrats, what have you, decent human beings, all we want to do is keep women down by giving them free birth control. Meanwhile, Mr. Huckabee's party wants to lift women up by taking food away from them. Mercy, I love how that works.
And if the Democrats want to insult the women of America by making them believe that they are helpless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing for them a prescription each month for birth control because they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of the government, then...
Oh, Dr. Freud, did you get... Yes, Bob? Did you catch that line about how... Oh, golly Moses, about how women can't control their libidos?
Well, you see, Bob, once upon a time I talked about some of these things as well, but I've realized that the Republican Party was absolutely working me right out of my bit. This is absolutely fascinating that you would have this fellow who opposes a woman's right to choose what to do with her reproductive system, at the same time telling that somehow or another they are unable to control their own sexuality. It sounds positively 19th century.
Duh.
Thanks, Doc. Got a light? Yeah, right there.
So be it. Let us take that discussion all across America, because women are far more than the Democrats have played them to be, and women across America need to stand up and say, enough of that nonsense.
Yeah, enough of that nonsense. We don't want no birth control pills. We want to stay home and pregnant and barefoot and in the kitchen where God and the little hubby want us to be. Sure. In Jesus' name, amen. Just beautiful, isn't it? Like I said, Thorn in the Side Thursday certainly fits the bill, doesn't it? Darlene with a note writing, Phyllis Schlafly is a horrid woman. I blame her up front and center for putting a halt to the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. What a nasty old bat. Was she the one that was, is she, I can't remember. There have been a couple of chunks of the culture war that have fallen out of place for me. Is she the woman that suggested that a wife meet her husband at the door wearing nothing but saran wrap? Was that her? Maybe not. But that's the kind of right-wing battery. Yes, battery. That's the kind of right-wing battery that was going on back during the ERA debate. Uh-oh, I think we've agitated Darlene. What? Uncle Sugar? Women can't control their libidos? God, these pigs are sleazy. But you gotta be a complete dolt not to see through it. Yeah, the problem is, though, Darlene, there's a lot of complete dolts in America. Yeah, I ran across a guy today who was running around in his vehicle with the big banner on the letter stickers on the back of his SUV. Said, Obama, one big ass mistake, America. See, it spells Obama, one big ass mistake, America. Obama, clever, huh? Babbling on about how it was cold outside, and that's that damn liberal global warming for you. And I looked at him and said, actually, it is global warming, because while it's cold here, there are unseasonably weird temperatures elsewhere, and Australia's really hot. You know, what about the ice ages? What about them? That wasn't global. Oh, never mind. And I just went about my business of getting a loaf of bread and some peanut butter. But that's, you know, that's how it plays. Dr. John, the GOP recognizes equality of women? Of course. That's what the GOP stands for. Equal pay for comparable work. Expanded health care covering free mammograms, pap smears, total prenatal care, and all other preventative gynecological screens. Flexible family leave and extending hate crime statutes to cover sexual assault. Wait, they don't stand for any of that? No, they don't stand for any of that. But by God, they likes them some women folk. So we'll take a little break now, and I'm going to jump into this. Conversation, this interview, and I'll see if we can simulcast it. And if we can, I'll be right back. If we can't, I'll probably be back about half an hour. Stand by.
Over quite a bit, and then you start to factor in. The real question should be asked, how much water is going to be wasted and destroyed on the oil fields in Kern and elsewhere in the Monterey Shale? And then you're talking about 10 million acre-feet of water. So that's enough water to provide L.A. with all of its needs for 20 years. But these guys aren't, you know, recharging the groundwater. They're mixing it with toxic chemicals, naturally occurring chemicals. It's not coming back into the water cycle for our consumption. It's being destroyed.
And then adding to that, by declaring a drought emergency, a slightly off topic but really on topic, Governor Brown has essentially made it possible for opponents of the Endangered Species Act, back to that, to strip away really water quality protections for Bay Delta fisheries. And what will that mean, for instance, to Delta family, you know, small farms and Delta urban communities?
Well, that they're really a potential victim of these practices, and that's why the Restore the Delta Coalition is formed to unify Delta fishermen, family farmers, business interests to fight this theft of water being facilitated by the governor. This is Jerry Brown tried to do this 30 years ago. He's trying again, and we're going to have to beat him again. That's water is for fighting for, and whiskey is for drinking, as Mark Twain said.
I was reading too. The state and federal water agencies exported massive quantities over the years, massive quantities of water to, of course, corporate agribusiness, and developers, oil companies. They're by endangering local water supplies, Chinook salmon, I think you mentioned steelhead, delta fish populations, and the ecosystem really continues to just collapse all around us here in California.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of things we've already been dealing with, and there's the fracking challenge, and the tunnels comes on top of problems that need to be reversed. So
you have the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of Water Resources allowing the overpumping of the Delta by, what was it, 800,000 acre feet or something last year, apparently to sort of meet the needs of the Westlands Water District, as you were talking about, the Kern County Water Agency. And I understand that these mega growers in these two water districts have used more exported water combined than the Metropolitan Water District and the Santa Clara Valley Water District over the last 10 years. So doesn't this sort of force farmers and ranchers to compete with the fracking industry for water, exacerbating the impact of climate change and making California more vulnerable to these mega drought conditions?
Well, it's a great question, and thus far they've been taking too much and their strategy is just to take more and more and more, and there's got to be limits, and those limits have to be enforced. It's going to be very interesting to see what kind of deals and the tension that's going to grow as the oil industry attempts to expand and wants more water with really no excess water in the state. And we suspect that they're going to outbid farmers for water. They're going to buy off small farmers' water rights. We've seen this happening in Colorado already, and in the drought. I think we're going to see it here as well. That's really why and just another reason on top of many reasons fracking should be stopped. It should be banned.
Adam, we have to go to break, but can you just talk really briefly about SB4 and tell people again the websites they can go to for more information?
As mentioned, Governor Brown signed SB4 in the fall to give permission for the oil industry to keep fracking us. But right now, through our work with Californians Against Fracking, we're putting enormous pressure, and we need everybody's help to put more pressure on Governor Brown to ban fracking or put a moratorium on it as a step towards a ban. So everybody can help play a role in this. It's going to require a broad and powerful coalition of voters, environmentalists, public health people, farmers. So people can get involved with us at foodandwaterwatch.org, and they can see our coalition website at californiansagainstfracking.org.
Adam Scal, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I'm Sandy Leon Vest. You are listening to Political Analysis. And don't forget that there are a lot of big oil, big fossil fuel players in this whole scene that's going on in California. We'll be back in a few minutes with Bob Kincaid. I'm Sandy Leon Vest again. This is the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you. Bobby Elias.
And it's Dr. Sarah Larson.
Host of Let's Create a Better World. Our show is for your body, mind, and soul to have the latest, greatest cultural, creative information available.
Join us with our expert guests every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific.
You can also hear our show on the phone at 619-550-0869.
And don't forget about the archives.
We're moving forward on PRN.FM.
And we want you to come with us.
Saturdays, don't forget, every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific. Let's create a better world.
This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
Are you craving real talk about parenting today? I'm Louise Kuo Habakus.
And I'm Allison McNeil.
We are the co-hosts of Fearless Parent Radio. If you feel like your instincts are better than 90% of what you're hearing, it's time to tune in to a provocative new show that's funny, smart, and honest. Fear sells, but not here. From hair in the sink to hair on end, nothing is off limits.
Tune in to hear writers, experts, and parents with guts and strong opinions. Listen Wednesdays, 11 a.m. Eastern at PRN.FM. If you miss the show live, catch us 24/7 on iTunes. For a radio show that's blasting through fear and finding a dynamic way forward.
This is Mike Fader. I'm the host of Occupied Territory, broadcast every Thursday on PRN.FM at 2 p.m. Eastern. This show is based on the principles of the Occupy movement, and at the bottom of everything, income inequality. So tune in every Thursday at 2 p.m. to hear interviews with people who are out there doing it, and articles, essays, and rants by yours truly on the Occupy movement and its ideals, and how we can set democracy straight without using the system to do it. That is PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. And you better come with us, you know what I'm saying?
And welcome back to Political Analysis. I'm your host, Sandy Leon Best, and tonight we're airing our second installment of the Unharmonic Convergence series that began last week. This week, water, water everywhere. By now, most of our listeners know about the disastrous chemical spill that dumped massive quantities of a chemical known as crude MCHM into West Virginia's Elk River. What some of you may not know, however, is that on Tuesday of this week, it was revealed that yet another chemical was found in the tank that spilled the crude MCHM more than 2 weeks ago. And we're talking here about a public drinking water supply. What really should be called a toxic infusion into the Elk River came about as a direct result of the negligence of West Virginia's Freedom Industries. And as has been widely reported, the accident left some 300,000 people in the surrounding area without water. Freedom Industries disclosed the new information to state and federal regulators on Tuesday morning, just this last Tuesday. But they now claim that the exact identity of the substance is quote, proprietary. So this catastrophic event is only the most recent episode of contamination in West Virginia, a state where what political analysis is calling the unharmonic convergence is manifesting itself in a big way. And now I'm joined by West Virginia activist and radio talk show host Bob Kincaid, who my friend, human rights and anti-coal activist and author Jeff Biggers has called the best local voice on coal and water issues in West Virginia. Bob joins us to talk about the recent chemical spill, water privatization, mountaintop removal, fracking, drought, resource wars, as really all of this, as much as we can cover. And again, all of this in the context of runaway climate change. So here now to talk about what's happening as we speak in his home state of West Virginia, a progressive radio host and co-founder of the Appalachian Community Health Emergency. I think the locals call it Appalachian. Bob Kincaid. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sandy. I have a feeling that if we've got about a day and a half, we should be able to cover all of that in pretty good depth.
Yeah, we'll get to what we can, and then we'll have you back. You might have to be a regular for a while.
I'd be happy to do that. We badly want to get this message out about the degree to which West Virginia and Central Appalachia have been laid across the coal industry and the chemical industry's bloody altar that is dedicated to holy profit.
And we badly want to help you do just that. So maybe you can begin by just telling people briefly what happened 2 weeks ago in West Virginia. Most know, but just briefly, and then specifically what happened to the Elk River, and then maybe talk a little about this recent revelation, you know, yet another chemical adding to this toxic mess.
Actually, we could even go further back, Sandy. We could start talking about what's been happening in Appalachia for the last 125 years. But a week ago, the 9th of January, which is 2 weeks ago, really,
yes.
There was an announcement that there had been a spill of a chemical into the Elk River by an outfit called Freedom Industries, Orwellian, to say the least, and that it was upstream of the public drinking water supply. And at first there were three counties told not to use the water, and then it expanded until ultimately nine counties in the Kanawha Valley were told not to drink the water that this chemical was in it that was later identified as crude methyl cyclohexane methanol, which is an agent that is used in the coal preparation process all over southern West Virginia and central Appalachia. So this stuff was in the water. It was discovered because ordinary citizens began smelling a stink, and they called it into the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, who apparently were unable, with their sort of coal-controlled noses, to notice the stink themselves. So they went driving across the river and went and had a look over near the water company, and lo and behold, a mile and a half upriver sits this old, poorly designed tank farm with a 4-foot-wide stream of this stuff pouring into the river. And there was so much pressure behind it that at one point, one DEP investigator said it looked like an artesian well of the stuff just bubbling up.
Mm.
And so these things are being discovered in the early morning. The administration of Governor Earl Ray Tomblin, a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry, waited about 10 hours before they told people not to drink it, not to use it for anything but flushing and firefighting. That was what was said. So there were 10 hours where mothers were bathing their babies in this poison.
Mm.
There were 10 hours where mothers were making baby formula with this poison. There were 10 hours where hospitals were using this poisoned water with their patients in various stages of distress. There were 10 hours where this poison was running through the pipes in our nursing homes, in our elementary schools, in our high schools, in our colleges, our universities, our public buildings. 10 hours before they said, don't drink it.
And Bob Kincaid, you're referring here to the EPA?
No, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection under Governor Earl Ray Tomblin.
Okay, and you describe them as a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal, really an unwholly owned.
Well, amen to that.
Yeah, and so the West Virginia Department, say it again.
Of Environmental Protection.
Of Environmental Protection.
We call them the West Virginia Department of Environmental Permitting.
Oh, bad. So they waited 10 hours after they knew the degree, really, of this catastrophe to let people know to stay away, from not to drink the water, not to bathe their children in the water.
Yes.
I mean,
And they had no idea what it was. See, this is the way things operate in West Virginia, Sandy. We didn't know what the poison was, so we figured we'd just let it go on pouring into the river. Because maybe it's a good poison.
Yeah. I was reading in the publication, I think it's called Nation of Change, that back in September, I think it was, that West Virginia's Pond Fork River in Boone County actually turned white, and it turned out that the culprit was a chemical called DT-50D.
Yes.
Some, you know, over 2,400 gallons of it. And my understanding is that this toxic chemical, DT-50D, is used to cover coal and rail cores, I guess, to cut down on dust.
On dust, right, because coal dust is toxic, too.
Right. So this substance apparently leaked into the river from the Eastern Associated Coal Prep Plant. I mean, offering up really yet another example of how the coal and chemical industries have just polluted West Virginia beyond recognition, which we should mention here is, I think, the second poorest state in the nation. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You're correct.
Okay. So, and you recently observed that in West Virginia, and this is a quote, everything has been for sale to the highest bidder. Will you elaborate on that?
This is one of those 125-year things. The boom in energy extraction, coal extraction, oil and natural gas begins with the companies coming in and using various legal practices and tactics and shady, tricks to do people out of their land. At which point they no longer owned their mineral rights, and the door was wide open. And from the very beginning of West Virginia's existence in 1863, this state has been operated on a model that says that we cannot be self-sufficient, that we need outside people to come in and bring their money and do whatever to us that they need to do in order to create prosperity. Now, it's 100-plus years, and the prosperity still hasn't gotten here on that model.
Well, at least not what we would call prosperity.
No, it's all gotten on rail cars and barges and trucks, and it's left the state. But whatever industry wants, industry gets. The legislature is in session here right now, Sandy, and they just spent today watering down rules to keep poisons out of streams. I'm not kidding.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if you were listening to the first half of the show, but the same thing, I mean, with respect to everything being for sale to the highest bidder, is happening in California. We have Governor Jerry Brown with, you know, really in bed with the fossil fuel industry, big oil and gas, you know, Shell Oil, ExxonMobil, Vinoco, Occidental, Chevron, all of them, and they're just fracking the guts out of California right now, along with any number of other atrocities. But, you know, it's pretty much the same all over. It's more a matter of degree. And I think in West Virginia, where you are, because the people are struggling and have to depend really on the coal industry in many cases just to survive, you've really got a poignant and terrible problem there. And I want to just quote, if you'll bear with me, from that article that I was talking about earlier. It was written by Emily Acton and Katie Valentine, and they say, quote, in a state where 17.8% of the population lives in poverty and 47% of children live in low-income families, many West Virginians depend on jobs from the chemical or coal industries, the same industries responsible for polluting the state's water. Coal mining in West Virginia states that in 2011 ranked 49th out of 50 in terms of median household income, supports more than 88,000 jobs, while the chemical industry supports about 12,000. Any attempt to put strict regulation on those industries is therefore met with hostility from those whose families have for generations depended on the jobs to get by. So, you know, this is a big problem, isn't it?
It's a huge problem. And it's one of the problems that comes when you put all of your eggs in one basket. I dispute that 88,000 jobs number because whenever the coal industry starts counting up coal jobs, they will include the job of the guy who slices bologna for sandwiches down at the mm-hmm. Rippy Mart that some guy who drives a truck will stop by and pick up two of on it. That's a coal job.
Yeah, ancillary, I think they call it. Ancillary jobs.
You know, there are less than 5,000 mountaintop removers in this state as we speak. There are more Walmart workers in this state. There are more nurses. There are more florists than there are mountaintop removal workers. It is not the economic engine that it is portrayed
okay.
to be. There are, I think it's less than 6% of the state's gross economy is coal.
So you would dispute then what the authors of that article say?
I do because it creates what appears to be an intractable situation.
A no-win situation where there's no way out.
Right, and there has to be.
And you're going to talk about that before we let you off the air. But I was thinking, as you were saying, it's so ironic that Freedom Industries, I mean, the name itself is ironic, but it's also ironic that this is a factory that reportedly, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is involved in clean, quote unquote, cleaning coal.
Yes, that's what the chemical is used for. It's put on tanker trucks and driven all over southern West Virginia, northern West Virginia, who knows where. To coal prep plants, and when they're done with the chemicals, they pump them up behind an earthen dam in a giant toxic sea that contains billions of gallons of toxic waste. They're visible from space.
That people really need to travel to see. I have seen that, and that is just an amazing thing to behold.
Well, you know, you can do it from the comfort of your own computer. You can go to Google Earth, for instance, and simply look for Whitesville, West Virginia, and pretty soon, if you look around, you'll see this big black dot that looks like it might be a lake or something. That's the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere.
Wow.
It's called the Brushy Fork Impoundment, and it is permitted to hold back up to 9 billion, with a B, gallons of toxic waste.
How safe is that stuff? I mean, it's not safe that it's even there, but how insulated is it?
It's not lined or anything, if that's what you mean.
Wait, I'm sorry?
It's not lined or anything. It's just a valley that's been dammed off, and it sits atop a bunch of old underground coal mines that are full of water. And, you know, one of these days it's going to burst, and the engineers say when it bursts, it'll send a 40 to 60-foot wall of toxic waste running down the coal river valley. Now, back in 1972, when one of the coal industry's dams burst, it was only a couple of hundred million gallons, and that killed 125 people.
And then there was the coal ash, I remember.
Yeah, that was the Buffalo Creek disaster in February of 1972.
Right.
And of course, the response of the coal industry was, well, wait a minute, why are we storing more than 100 million gallons of toxic waste behind an earthen dam? Mm. Let's store billions of gallons.
Yeah. I want you, though, Bob, before we go off the air, to talk about how citizens are fighting back. You talk about what you call the spirit of Appalachian self-determination, which led to the introduction in the U.S. House recently of representatives of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency called the AIC Act, right?
Yes.
H.R. 526 in the 113th Congress. Talk more about the AIC Act.
As quickly as I possibly can. Essentially, a few years ago, scientific reports began coming out that showed us that just living near mountaintop removal sites was dangerous to your health. It was dangerous in the form of birth defects, increased cancer rates, increased heart disease rates. And it comes from both the toxification of the air from 5.5 million pounds of high explosives. That's roughly the equivalent of about 4,000 cruise missiles delivered to Appalachia daily. It comes from those explosions. It comes from the toxification of the water. And so based on that science and using science as our guide, we got introduced into the Congress, and first in the 112th and then in the 113th Congress, H.R. 526, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. That spells AIC, the AIC Act. And what it does is it says enough is enough. We're not going to issue any more permits for new mountaintop removal operations.
A moratorium,
essentially. It is a moratorium, and during the pendency of the act, we're going to do fully funded federal studies to find out why it is that people who live near mountaintop removal sites experience increased death, increased heart disease, increased cancer, increased birth defects. And at the end of the study, the Secretary of Health and Human Resources has to certify whether or not mountaintop removal can be safely done around human populations. And if it can't, it becomes illegal to do.
Wow.
It's basically a matter of putting into practice a thing called, that many of your listeners may be familiar with, called the precautionary principle.
Precautionary principle. Hello. Yeah, I mean, that is so important. So, again, you're saying that if, under the AIC Act, and if after this study, so it's the first the moratorium on new mountaintop removal permits, and then this is pending a full study, a federal study of the health issues that are affecting mountaintop removal communities. And then after the study, if the coal companies can't show that they can do, you know, what they do without poisoning and killing people, the practice becomes illegal.
Correct.
And in fact, to make this happen, what needs to happen is people have to, from all over this country, contact their various members of Congress and demand that they sign on to H.R. 526, House Resolution 526.
Exactly. And we need it introduced in the Senate, too, Sandy. People need to be calling their senators and saying, why have you not introduced this in the Senate?
All right. Contact senators. Because really, Bob, let's go out with this. We're talking about water. We're talking about a human rights issue.
It absolutely is. As long as this remains confined to the environmental ghetto, we're gonna continue having disasters like this. We have to understand these things, Sandy, as human rights existential crises that can only be answered by citizen determination and citizen action. And anybody who wants to learn more about the AIC Act can go to ACHEACT.org, AIC Act.org. The science is there. The bill is there. There's even a widget where you can contact your member of Congress.
And all of this against the backdrop of out of control climate change. You know, it's really essential. So again, people can go to AIC Act.org. That's www.AIC, as in I have a headache, www.AIC Act.org. And Bob, you're urging people to read the science, read the bill, and then contact their member of Congress and their senators.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you so much for the opportunity to tell your listeners about this. We need your help. And frankly, there's a PayPal button there, too. And if anybody wants to click that, will go a long way toward making it more possible for the people of the AIC campaign to do their work.
Bob Kincaid, stay in touch. And we'll definitely have you back on during this series on harmonic convergence.
I look forward to the opportunity, Sandy. Thank you so much and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much. And I'm Sandy Leon Vest. That was Bob Kincaid. You are listening to Political Analysis, aired weekly Thursdays, 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.
Okay, what'd you think? I think it's kind of neat to do a simulcast on this kind of stuff. Well, thank you, Bean. Bean says nice. There's some applause going on in the chat room. Aw, shucks. Thank you, Jan. Jan says right on the mark. So, wow, there's the first hour of the program. Let's get the conversation started. We'll take a little break now because I get all nervous and dry mouthed and stuff during these interviews. We'll take a little break, and it being Thorn in the Side Thursday and everything, we can also count on Brad and Desi to be here with the Green News Report, which is on its way. So you know the phone number, right? 304-658-3333. Light it up if you want to. And we'll come back and move on, because there is some more thorn in the side stuff out of this ongoing disaster, and we probably ought to talk about it. This is Conversation Radio, listener supported. This is the horn. We need to raise $130 this evening. 13 at 10, 10 at 13, 26 at 5. You know how it goes. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll be back. This is the horn.
It's Thursday, January 23, 2014.
Everything has been done in this state for the corporate good.
Surprise! Second toxic chemical also contaminating West Virginia's water supply.
I've heard of Tornado Alley. I've never heard of Earthquake Alley.
Texas homeowners don't care for fracking earthquakes. Keystone XL Pipeline Southern Leg now open for business. Score one for the Arctic. Setback for Shell's excellent Arctic adventure. Plus,
the field at Dodger Stadium has been undergoing a magical transformation.
Full speed ahead for LA's first ever outdoor pro hockey game.
It's not exactly hockey weather.
It's going to be in the mid-70s today in Los Angeles.
Whoops.
Whoops indeed. All of those whoopsies and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
That's what it's all about. In a nutshell, is what the whole issue of global warming is all about, the spread of communism.
The who of the what? Rush Limbaugh?
That's what global warming is. It's merely a platform to advance communism.
Well, when you run out of all other arguments, go for the communism thing. That'll work. This is your Green News Report. Okay, comrade Desi Doyen, I'm a big hockey fan. Every year the NHL has an outdoor hockey game. This year it's going to be out here in L.A. this weekend. Very exciting.
Yeah, the warm weather that's breaking records in Southern California is not stopping the National Hockey League from playing its first ever outdoor hockey game west of the Rockies. It'll be in Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles in the middle of a record heat wave and a record drought.
It has been 80s and 90s out here for the past 6 weeks. This is amazing that they're going to try to play hockey over this weekend.
Yeah, the ice will be protected from the heat with a giant insulated Mylar blanket. Great use of water in a record drought, guys.
Man.
Update in the West Virginia chemical spill. Nearly 2 weeks after a toxic chemical spill contaminated the water supply in West Virginia, the company responsible for the spill, Freedom Industries, has only now informed officials that a second toxic chemical was also in that spill. 12 days later, as officials scramble to conduct new tests of the water, West Virginia radio host, our friend, and Green News Report affiliate, Bob Kincaid, on MSNBC slammed the state's lax oversight and response to toxic industries.
This state has been a model for the liquidation of the commons for the good of business interests. There is an ongoing involuntary experiment on a human population of about 300,000 people, and it's utterly unconscionable at this point in time.
The issue of oversight,
or lack thereof,
yes, is also shaking up the agenda in Texas. After a sudden increase in earthquakes, residents of North Texas this week demanded state regulators shut down wastewater injection wells. These wells are used by the fracking industry to permanently store toxic wastewater and have been linked to the drastic increase in earthquakes that are now damaging their homes, damage that is not covered by insurance.
Residents who say they are finding sinkholes now in their land and cracks in their buildings were told it could take a change in the law to get any relief.
Is somebody going to help us? They help the hurricane people. I've heard of Tornado Alley. I've never heard of Earthquake Alley.
The powerful three-member Texas Railroad Commission, which oversees the oil and gas industry in the state, says it will hire its own experts and won't halt the injection wells without new state legislation. Good luck with that.
Is that where they get the term railroaded from the Texas Railroad Commission?
Would not be too surprised if so. Meanwhile, also in Texas, the southern leg of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline is now open for shipping dirty tar sands oil from Oklahoma to refineries on the Gulf Coast. The southern leg didn't need presidential approval because it doesn't cross an international border. Texas landowners say they are running a giant neighborhood watch to look out for spills because new data shows 80% of all pipeline spills are discovered by people, not the expensive high-tech monitoring equipment touted by the oil industry.
Do I understand that right? In Texas, Texans are mad about tar sands oil and about natural gas fracking?
Yes, the chickens are coming home to roost, as it were.
Yeah, what is this world coming to?
Score one for the Arctic. for now. Remember Shell Oil's tragic comedy of errors in offshore drilling in the Arctic? In a lawsuit brought by major environmental groups and Native American tribes, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week that the Bush administration Interior Department was wrong to award offshore drilling leases to Shell to drill in the Alaskan Arctic. The court found the agency didn't consider all the environmental risks of oil production in the Arctic.
Didn't the Obama administration also approve that drilling in the Arctic for Shell?
Yes, they did. The Bush administration approved the leases. The Obama administration approved the permits.
Unity. I like to see that. Bringing the country together, ripping the Arctic apart. Very nice. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please stop by our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help celebrate our 10th anniversary at bradblog.com.
Woohoo!
Download us on iTunes, like us on the Facebook, and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
With you for me and me for you,
we'll muddle through whatever we do
together.
Together.
I love those two, Brad and Desi. The only time I've ever met them in person was out at Netroots Nation in Las Vegas. And I kept there were partitions in the whole exhibit hall area, and I kept hearing this voice and hearing this voice. And I went around the corner, and the person with the voice was coming around the corner, and we looked at each other, and she said, "I swore I heard Bob Kincaid's voice." And I looked at her and said, "I swore I heard Desi's voice. And now I hear Brad's voice." And it was the one time we've ever met. It was ever so brief and absolutely delightful, which is that's part of the beauty of radio. I wouldn't have known him, but I heard the voice. Thanks very much to Diana out in Washington State. She's gotten us started with our fundraising this evening, and we now have only $105 to go to make this evening's fundraising goal. Diana with a note, "Thank you for the truth, Bob. Out here in Olympia, Washington, we are now exposed to the Fukushima radiation. We don't hear nor know how much. Move along. Nothing to see syndrome. Love your radio voice." Well, thank you, Diana. Thank you very much. And see, it's all a part of a larger picture. This idea of immoral, unconscionable experiments taking place is not limited to West Virginia or to Appalachia. That's an experiment taking place in the Pacific right now. How much meltdown radiation can we send across the Pacific Ocean and get away with? Or in Texas, or in California, or in God knows Pennsylvania, or the frac sand mining area of Wisconsin? How much poison can we subject people to and have them still be willing to sit on their butts at home watching Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child? Because, see, that's what's important, that threshold right there, because you don't want folks getting out of the seat, onto the feet, and into the street, because then there's a problem, because that gets in the way of the money. There's an internet, and it's funny in its own way, there's an internet meme going around regarding coal companies and terrorists, but the fact of the matter is, you know, that you heard the clip there from that Brad and Desi played, where Rush Limbaugh says climate change science is just a bunch of commies. And if it is, I mean, it's not, but let's assume for a moment that it is. Did commies poison the water supply of 300,000 people? Now, we are in ever since the late 90s, and certainly since September 11, 2001, in an absolute paranoid frenzy over the terrorists. Did Al-Qaeda poison the water supply of 300,000 people? Has Al-Qaeda depleted 30 communities in West Texas of their ability to drink fresh water via fracking? Did Al-Qaeda send a tsunami and then create an earthquake? No, that was gay people. that wrecked a nuclear power complex in Fukushima? Was that commies? How many more of these do we have to list? Did commies cause Love Canal? I didn't think so. I didn't think so at all. Did commies or Al-Qaeda blow up an oil platform in the Gulf of Mexico? No, no. Okay, I know. It had to be commies and Al-Qaeda commies. That's what it was, Al-Qaeda commies. It had to be Al-Qaeda commies who breached the coal ash dam in East Tennessee, creating the Kingston coal ash disaster that sent ashbergs of highly concentrated toxic waste bobbing down the Tennessee River. That had to... No? No. Mm-hmm. Well, who did that? Wait. You mean all of that was done by good, upstanding, God-fearing, America-firsting capitalist patriots? And they did it just for money? Oh, hell. That sounds like a six-sided die, and only one dot is Al-Qaeda commies. Everything else comes up capitalism, and then somebody's dead. Jeez. Kind of makes you think, you know, with friends like these. Oh, there it is. Absolutely. Jan has nailed it in the chat room. Gay Al-Qaeda commies. Had a note from Kate a little bit ago. She said, Bob, there is a goddess who answers my entreaties. I have been pleading for all those homophobes to move to one place and leave the rest of us alone. They should all gather in a big old place south of the Mason-Dixie line, build a fence around the whole area, and we could slop them through the fence. And Kate said, oh, I agree with Darlene, by the way. Phyllis Schlafly should cross over in peace. She has been under my skin since we didn't ratify the ERA. Yeah, I'm that old, says Kate. And the Reverend Huxterby should hold the door for her as they both cross over together. What pigs those folks are. Signed, Kate, chained to the stove and barefoot. And by the way, during the break, we sorted out who the wrap yourself in saran wrap and meet your hubby at the door lady was. That was not Phyllis Schlafly, but it was during the same era, ERA, yeah, see, a witty one. It was during the same era that a woman named Maribel Morgan, which is, as fundy names goes, is right up there with Marjo Gortner. But Maribel Morgan wrote the number one best-selling nonfiction book of 1974 called The Total Woman. And it was all about women recognizing their place in the universe and that their place was largely to be caught in a cycle of permanent concubinage to their husbands, to the extent that she recommended that a woman wrap herself in nothing but saran wrap and meet her husband at the door with the pipe and the slippers and the martini and, well, just to do whatever it is he needs to do. That it was the job of the woman to deal with the quirks and oddities, or peccadillos, perhaps, of the man. Sweet. And we're still paying the price for that stupidity. Why is it? This is not a rhetorical question. This is a function of me not even remotely understanding the workings of the right-wing brain. Why is it that there is no possibility of an equal relationship inside a right-wing fundamentalist marriage or cohabitation, or, well, it has to be marriage, I mean, you know, in a church and everything? Maribel Morgan was a fundy, but she was a fundy who wanted women in saran wrap. Where does that even come from? I mean, what part of, you know how Mike Huxterby said women can't control their libidos? What part of the Maribel Morgan libido came up with, I think I'm going to wrap myself up in a little saran wrap and meet him at the door and let him peel me like a grape? I mean, maybe that's fun. Maybe. And who's to, I'm not the person to say it isn't. But her teaching back then in 1974 has had legs, so to speak. And it is still filtering noxiously down upon the culture. Because right-wingers, authoritarians, repiglickens, teabaggers, fundies, evilgelicals, birthers, deathers, tenthers, booger-eaters, all have this model within their operational schema that says in any relationship, one person must be superior to the other person. And I don't get that. Why cannot two people meet on common ground and exist and build a relationship based upon mutual respect and equality? I'm lost. Why does someone have to dominate? Why does someone have to submit? And I say this because, lo and behold, it turns out here in the year 2014, there's a Congress critter named Steve Pierce, who is a repiglickin from New Mexico Stan, who is still out there. He's got a book out. Of course he does. He's got a book out. And his book is never mind. I'm not going to give you the title. I'm not going to help hustle his book. No way. But lo and behold, inside his book, there it is. In the book, Pierce recounts his rise to owning an oil field service company and winning election to Congress. In the book, the Vietnam War veteran says that both the military chain of command and the family unit need a structure in which everyone plays his or her role. Well, okay, a structure. I'm not anti-structure. What kind of structure? He said that in his family's experience, this meant that his wife, Cynthia, would submit to him and he would lead. He gets to be the general, she gets to be the buck private. And this is a quote. The wife is to voluntarily submit just as the husband is to lovingly lead and sacrifice, he writes, citing the Bible. The husband's part is to show up during the times of deep stress, take the leadership role, and be accountable for the outcome, blaming no one else. The wife's submission is not a matter of superior versus inferior. Rather, it is self-imposed as a matter of obedience to the Lord and love for her husband. So Jesus won't like you if every word out of your mouth isn't, yes, dear. And we wonder why we have problems with the American family in 2014. Because we're hanging on to a toxic notion of family. And we're hanging on for all we're worth. So here we go again. 2014, and the repiglickens are telling the women folk to sit down and shut the up. When I want to know, you know, when we want to know what you think, we'll tell you. Until then, we'll tell you what's good for you. And we'll do that because we love you so much, because we recognize that you've got these crazy libidos that make you just sit around and want to munch on birth control pills like M&M's. Mm-hmm. Don't you love it? So this is Thursday, Thorn in the Side Thursday. We're about halfway through the program this evening. And let's go to the phones, 304-658-3333. If you want to jump in via Skype, that's opened up too. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype, BobKincaidHorn. And whichever way works best for you is fine by me. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob.
How are you, Kevin?
Good. That was a great article. It was a great interview you did there.
Thank you.
She played that clip of the Davey and Brad played that clip of the MSNBC interview, and I barely recognized your voice. In fact, when they played the clip at the intro, I assumed that was you too, saying a wholly owned subsidiary or something like that. They played in the intro to the Green News Report. Do you remember that?
I think I was in the intro.
Yeah. And I didn't even realize it was you until later on when they played it, when they were doing the clip of you talking on MSNBC, and I realized it was the same Bob. So you have a different sounding voice on TV than you do on radio, is what I guess I'm trying to say. I don't know if that's a factor of the different equipment.
It is. It's how the microphone handles the sound pressure levels and the voice itself, and yeah, we're running it through a little compressor just to take out some of the background noise so that you don't hear the roar of the space heater or anything like that.
Well, I just wanted to call because first of all, I want to give a shout out to a few people. First of all, Jude in Washington State, I want to wish her the best. Last heard from her a couple weeks ago when she was visiting her children. And she was in a much warmer, nicer climate than we are. So, best to her. I hope she brings some of it back with her.
Here, here.
And
here,
here. I was also thinking, you mentioned, I forget her name now, the girl in Washington State that did the donation today.
Oh, Diana.
Diana. And it got me to thinking about some of the people we haven't heard from for a while. And I thought of Preston out here in Colorado because I haven't heard from Preston for a while. So I'm hoping.
I've seen a couple of posts from Preston on my Facebook page, and I get the idea that Preston really, really does walk the walk, and I think he stays pretty busy. But I love it when he calls in because we have wonderful conversations. You know, he remains the Horns' resident optimist.
Mm-hmm. And we desperately need the optimist because that leads me in the walking the walk phrase, leads me into what I kind of was saying, going to say this, what we see from the right wing is a lot of sound and fury. And by that, I mean just like Rush Limbaugh saying that global warming is communism. And we see so many different things in this, and whether it's controversial or not, what they say, they seem to always get the press over it. And on our side...
Well, isn't that the squeaky wheel factor, though, Kevin?
Exactly. But that's what I...
But after a while, squeaky wheels that already have all the grease... That tends to indicate that there's a defect in the wheel, not that it
exactly.
needs more grease.
Exactly. But at the same time, I think that just like you, for so many years, have been talking about the AICA Act, and only now, it seems, with this spill in West Virginia, are you getting the national press it deserves. We as liberals, conservatives, progressives, liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call us, we need to be a bit more vocal in getting our message out. Because at times I feel like, you know, we're just not, whether it's a function of the fact that most of the media is geared toward the corporate interest instead of our interest, but still, we, you know,
and some of that, and without jumping up on the soapbox here, some of that is a self-inflicted wound, Kevin, because frankly, a lot of organizations and groups on our side talk about wanting progressive media, but they will not support it, even though they have the means to do it. They're happy to leave it to y'all, okay? Which is just kind of shitty. Not y'all's willingness to keep things going. But their willingness to let you shoulder it when they can do it much more easily. And again, I'm not just talking about me. I know for a fact a number of individuals who have gone hat in hand and said, you know, listen, we want to do this for you. We already are doing this for you. And the gamut of responses runs from things like, well, why should I buy the milk when I'm going to, why should I buy the cow when I'm getting the milk for free? You're going to talk about these issues anyway, even if I don't give you money. Which is deeply cynical and embittering, but I know that story. We don't have any money, but we'll be happy to send you guests. And it's like, no, please, stop that. I don't need guests. I'm perfectly capable of talking about these issues all by myself. I've been engaged in the art of word knowing for at least, 49 years.
Yep.
I can handle that. But it's self-inflicted. And until such time as somebody wakes the hell up, it's going to continue to be that way. And they don't understand whether it's radio or TV or how they don't understand the medium. How many really, really good bloggers are there out there who are writing their asses off, do you suppose, who don't have health care and who don't have a livable wage?
Probably a good number of them.
I'd say probably more, I'm guessing, more than not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But when you think about the good bloggers out there, they come from us, not the richer media types. In other words, a blogger like me or you has a lot more to say than, say, and I'm just throwing out a name as an example, than, say, a Rachel Maddow. She has her show. She really can't say anything different or new doing a blog. Whereas you and I, we can tell the story from our own personal life experience and what we deal with on a daily basis. And that's why I think it is that most of us that do blog don't have health care or a good job or much means, because we're telling real life stories of day to day existence that, just like you in West Virginia, even though it doesn't affect you, it affects your family, it affects your state. This spill I'm talking about.
No, I get it. And the thing is, it does touch us all. And you know what?
Sure.
Because this can happen anywhere. It can.
Oh, well.
It really can. What's going to happen when the next crude oil train winds up killing not 50 like it did in Lochmagaddick, but 150 or 200? You know, the responses will be the same. Somebody will say, well, you know, this is intolerable. This is unacceptable. But nobody will say, let's stop it and study it. Let's put a moratorium on it until we know how to do it safely. And why is that, Kevin? Because the money doesn't like that.
Exactly.
The money can have the boys in accounting factor in however many people that they feel like they're going to blow up this year into the cost.
Right.
And still remain profitable so that the CEO gets a healthy bonus there in December.
Yep. And even if the CEO doesn't get a bonus, he's collected so many bonuses in the past that it really doesn't matter. You know, when you have an unlimited money supply source, you can factor in the cost of 200 people getting killed by one of your trains exploding in some town that it's gone through. And I find myself feeling two different things. The word wouldn't be depressed, discouraged maybe. I sometimes feel like, what's the point? I'll get an email asking.
No, it's easy to wander into the swamps of nihilism. It really is.
Yep. And then there are other times where like the story of the Mecklenburg police officer that didn't get charged in the murder of that unarmed black guy that got in the accident and went seeking help. I find myself posting, damn it, get out on the streets until we get out on the streets and start protesting this and start shutting government down, throwing ourselves on the gears, nothing is going to happen. But then when you try to get people to do that, that's the other thing. It's got to be more than just one person.
Yeah, I mean,
one person.
If you know what? All of these poisoners, all of these devotees of hyper-capitalistic mayhem, these extremists, because they're the extremists. They really are. They are the extremists. Let's understand. The Koch brothers are extremists. The Koch brothers are radicals, okay? But they are radical capitalists, extremist capitalists, and they require, in order for their scheme to succeed, Kevin, they require the acquiescence and pacifism and fear of the people they seek to dominate. You know what? We could change West Virginia government in less than a week. All it would take would be about 100,000 human beings descending upon the state capital of West Virginia and refusing to leave until the will of the people is done.
Yep.
And I mean, and when I say, I don't mean standing around with a candle in your hand singing Kumbaya either, okay?
Nope.
I mean, you march into the chambers of the government and you sit down and you refuse to leave. Then you sing Kumbaya so that they can't get any more of their dirty business done. And you have to have numbers sufficient that it's impossible to stop it.
Exactly.
And I hope that's not deemed subversive, because I'm saying that from a standpoint of absolute unbending patriotism, because this is not the government that we're supposed to have.
Nope. When you get an early Tomlin saying what he did the other day about you have a choice in whether you want to drink your water or not, and refusing to do anything about that, to not speak out when the freedom industry says that second chemical is proprietary, when you get that, it's time to make a change. And I really could give a flying, you know what, if it's deemed subversive by me or not. That's what it's going to take. Until we do that, it's just going to be the same old. Possible light is that in Texas now, as Brad and Busy mentioned, the people in Texas are getting the mic fed up with the earthquakes down there. And the people in California are watching their water go to the frackers instead of to themselves when they're in the middle of a drought. And the people in Colorado are seeing the same thing. And
so therein lies the rub, Kevin. It is one thing, and you may, people can be successful about this. You can get people to come out for a day.
Right.
But how do we create the support system whereby we say to people who have mortgages, who have insurance payments, who have groceries to buy, all of these things, how do we put a system in place that says, you'll be okay, we'll take care of you, you just have to come for as long as is needed? Okay? Once upon a time, unions had these things called strike funds.
Exactly.
And nobody would get rich, but nobody was going to starve either. And since those days, the other side have figured out that instead of, you know, just cudgeling us and throwing the chains around our ankles, but it might be smarter if they made the chains look like designer shoes.
Right.
And lined the cuff and lined the handcuffs with velvet.
Yep.
But that's the question that we have to answer.
And that's the question that I don't have an answer for, because I could get by myself doing it for a week. Granted, I don't work because of my disability knees, but I can still go stand in a picket line or sit in a do a sit-in for a week, and no big deal.
Yeah, see, I was telling a little history. We ran across some really, really old photos last night, and I was telling Ferg the history of two gentlemen who appear in a photo that's about 1925. One is a little boy who's maybe 6 or 7, and he would not live past December 1944. He would be killed in the Battle of the Bulge. The one standing to his left had been gassed as part of the American Expeditionary Force in the First World War. And I was telling him about what, you know, and it said so on my uncle's and my dad's cards when they went into the military in the Second World War. It said, you know, length of obligation. And it just said, for the duration.
Yep.
You know, you want to come home? Win this war. All right? And we don't have... I don't think we've internalized that mindset yet in terms of this basic struggle that we have for our very existence here on the home front. You know, you're not in this struggle until your problem is solved. You're in it whether you like it or not or realize it or not, and I'm not speaking directly to you, Kevin, that's a sort of impersonal you, for the duration. Because if everything gets to be okay where you live, you don't get to sit down. You have to keep caring. You have to keep giving a damn.
Yep.
And that may sound a little too pontificatory, but where my head is.
Because even if things are okay where I'm at here in Colorado, things may not be okay up in North Dakota, and all that water comes downstream. So sooner or later, things are not going to be okay here again.
Yeah. Who said eternal vigilance is the price of freedom?
I've heard the quote. Don't know who said it.
Well, they weren't kidding.
Nope. And that's what we have not been as a people in America, especially for the last 30 years. We turned our government over into...
Oh, that was Thomas Jefferson.
Especially.
The price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Yep. So.
And you're right. We haven't, you know, we haven't taken that deeply into ourselves. We haven't processed it as part of our essential being.
No, because, and there again, I go back to how do we fix this, because we've got a group that wants to co-opt Thomas Jefferson, change the meaning of what he said for their own purposes, who supports, to the detriment of their own self-interest, the Kochs and the corporatists, and yet there's a group of people like you, Brad, Desi, me, others, who are saying, no, we've got to stop this madness before we kill our world, before we kill ourselves.
Yeah.
And
I'm so sick of living in the environmental ghetto, I can't stand it anymore. Because it's where we pigeonhole stuff that we feel like is not as important as money.
Nope.
Some of that is self-inflicted wound too, but some of that is also the function of people of privilege imposing us or insisting that we occupy that space that they have defined for us. I mean, I saw a comment. Shame on me. Not shame on me, but I just need to know better. I saw some blog post about the disaster here in West Virginia, and somebody said, when will these people stop voting against their own self-interest? What am I supposed to make of such people?
Yep.
And the lights went off, and the horns sounded, and the sirens, and And the steam started coming out of my ears, and I think I said something like, what am I supposed to make of someone who refers to poisoned people as these people and then goes on to self-define what our own best interests are? What am I supposed to make of that person? I make of that person that they got a lot of privilege they need to check.
Yep. Yep.
These people.
I feel
like one of the aliens in Galaxy Quest. Those poor people.
You know,
we need your help. Yeah.
They weren't talking about you, though, Bob, and that's the frustrating part. Because
no, they were just making a broad blanket assumption that everybody here lives within the narrow definition of their own stereotypes.
Right, right. And I know that, but that's where the frustration comes in. Because you've got enough yahoos that feed into that stereotype.
Met one today.
Yeah.
Obama. Yep. One big ass mistake, America.
Yep.
I know he didn't come up with that by himself.
Nope. It's just, that's the frustration for me, because I know, just like you're in Colorado Springs, yeah, we vote for essentially what he wants to be as a dictator, now mayor, as our first strong mayor form of government. And he's alienated city council and hopefully won't get reelected. But it's very easy to say, you know, to the outsider looking in, well, you voted for him. Well, I didn't vote for him, and I know there are a good 40% of us here in the city that didn't vote for him.
Right. But that, of course, that raises up that wonderful clip from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Well, I didn't vote for you. You don't vote for kings. Well, how'd you become king then? Because there's an assumption of privilege that, well, it's awful hard to stop.
Well, it's also a worship of money, even by the ones who don't have money. Remember, I can't think of his name, Robin something or other, is his lifestyles of the rich and famous?
Robin Leach.
Remember that? Yeah. And remember how that was so popular for a short while? People just love to sit down and watch the lifestyles of those rich and famous people. And I'm like, why would I want to watch a program of people who are living a lifestyle that I can't even hope to have 1% of?
Yeah, well, you're supposed to live it vicariously through them, you see. Champagne wishes and caviar dreams. We went looking for the most expensive bowl of soup in the world. It took us to Japan, where we found a bowl of snake urine soup for $1,500. Yeah, I remember Robin Leach.
Yep, and that's... You know, you can turn on the radio. I posted this today. You can turn on the radio, and any time of the day or night on one of your local cable channel, religious channels, and see some preacher preaching, if you just sow a seed of faith, you'll have the same lifestyle we do. We're rich because we were faithful, and you just need to be that faithful.
You just need God to like you as much as he likes us.
Well, it's not even that. It's that you can attain this by doing this, which is solely false to begin with, but it's essentially still comes down to basic greed. I had a second cousin that was a con man, went to prison back in the 30s, kind of during the era of the gangs in Chicago and that, and he said, you can't be successful as a con man unless you prey on people's greed. If a person's not greedy, you're not going to con them.
The first commandment of W.C. Fields is you can't cheat an honest man.
Yep.
That's the absolute truth. There's a wonderful old George C. Scott film called the Flim Flam Man, I think. in which he, at one point, he says, I consider myself an educator. I teach people about their own human natures. And what he means by that is he hustles them out of their money because he plays upon their own inherent dishonesty.
Yep.
You can't cheat an honest man. Never give a sucker an even break. And don't smarten up a chump.
Professional wrestling, I've done that for years.
Well, sure. And so, you know, look, that's the cosmetics industry. That's the fashion industry. That's the oil industry, the coal industry. It's the business model, Kevin.
Yep.
That's MBA thesis stuff up there at that pile of brick and mortar that goes by the name of Harvard.
Yep. So, I don't know. It all goes in a big circle for me because we got to keep doing what we're doing, but we also got to figure out a way to do things better, I guess is what I'm saying. Because even as you're saying that's the NBA model, we know that. We know people are greedy. That doesn't make a right. And how do we convince people? So we're much better off as a species looking out for one another instead of trying to take each other's money. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I know what it is for me in my own personal life, but that's just me as one person in a city of 100,000, 200,000 people in the county of a million. So, you know.
See, I hear numbers like that, and I go a little sideways because there's only 1.5 million people in the whole state of West Virginia.
Well, I didn't realize you were that small numbers-wise. Yeah. We have that in our county.
Hell, there's more people in Rhode Island than there are in West Virginia.
Wow.
But we're that way for a reason.
Well, yeah.
I think the population has been higher, but that was the boom and bust economy of the coal industry. Mm-hmm. This place is hard to live in. It's frustrating to live in. But it is also visited from time to time by moments of absolutely transcendent, breathtaking magnificence and beauty. That you're just not likely to find a whole lot of other places.
Nope.
I mean, I don't want to put anybody off, but I see flat land and I feel kind of icky. I feel like, it's the opposite of claustrophobia. It's like agoraphobia. It's like, look at all this, man, where does it end?
Oh, yeah.
Whereas my world here is circumscribed by mountains that once reached much higher but are sufficient to define the horizon for me.
Yep.
And they make you feel safe. And they make you feel folded in and part of something.
Yep.
With the snow that's been falling and the brutal temperatures, even so, I was talking to Ferg earlier today, and I said, you know, if we had time today, we ought to just bundle up really, really good and go for a hike.
Yep.
Because it's mind clearing.
And if you can stand the cold, it is beautiful scenery. Yes, I'm blind now, but I once was sighted, and I did exactly that. I can remember going out with my girlfriend after a freshly fallen snow here in this mountaintop community and just walking around, seeing the sights. And
it makes it a different place. I posted.
Yeah, it does.
I forget what day it was. We were driving down to Charleston. And got to the foot of Gauley Mountain, and there was just a painted in fog where you couldn't tell what was substantial land, what was water, and what was water vapor. And the universe itself, it was a black and white photograph if you took it, and that way, and we stopped and took photographs. It was a black and white photograph even if you took it in color.
Oh, yeah.
And when we got to the foot of the mountain, Ferg and I at the same time went, wow! Yep. So, you know, there you go. Well, Kevin, it's awful good talking to you this evening. And let's do it again soon.
Yep, I'm sorry if I sound a little bit preachy, but it just...
No, I don't think you were at all.
Well, I hope not. I know when I get up on my soapbox, I'm preaching to the choir, but they really just get to me. These people called Tea Partiers especially, but anyone that even remotely is right-wing now just gets to me with the flawed logic that they possess, and I find it's pointless to debate them because that's another big difference.
Right, it's like the dude with his, you know, one big-ass mistake, America. You know, even climate change, and I just told him, actually, it is climate change, and we can expect more of such extremes like this, and he starts on about the godforsaken ice age and dinosaurs, and I just got my bread, my headed for the peanut butter aisle, and life's too short to argue with morons. That's why they're not allowed on this program, Kevin.
Sure. And rightfully so. They've got plenty of other good news. When I get a troll on Twitter, I just refer them to the other side of Twitter. Go back to your own site. Go to Breitbart.com. They'll be glad to hear what you got to say. Leave me alone. I don't want to hear it. So... but that's the difference between a progressive and a conservative. We could be willing to discuss something we disagree on.
Yeah, for instance, that really skeletally, skinny, frightening-looking blonde woman that shows up on Fox from time to time is out there desperately trying to get some attention right now, saying, nobody on MSNBC will debate a really intelligent conservative. Man, they just walk into that crap. Well, we haven't met any.
Exactly. And we may not agree with much on Ed Schultz on things, but guess what? Ed Schultz would rip you a new one with the first five words out of his mouth. But he's not going to bother, neither will Matt out, because you aren't intelligent, so... Go away.
Yeah, goodbye, scary skinny blonde lady.
Exactly.
So, and by the way, I am proud of MSNBC for what they've been doing, trying to keep a degree of focus on this disaster here. It's I think two nights now. Rachel's mentioned it.
Great.
Of course, Chris Hayes did what he did. Melissa Harris Perry has, of course, talked about it. And the thing is, it is a broader story. I was joking with Sandy Leon Vest there in that interview, but the fact of the matter is you can't talk about the poisoning of the water without talking about the 125-year history of abuse of the people of this state.
Yep.
I mean, Jeff Biggers pointed out to me the other day, we have known that black lung, that coal dust is toxic for human consumption. We've known that since 1831. And yet 1,000 people will die of black lung this year.
Yep.
Three a day.
Yep. And still they're trying to say that, oh, it's from some other cause. They were smokers, or it's due to some other environmental...
Well, not even that. No, they say, for instance, the company said, wear your respirator. Okay, now we've told you you have to wear your respirator. Government says we got to tell you you have to wear your respirator. But you know what? Only sissies wear respirators.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, but they're not shy about if something happens to you, telling you, no, you don't qualify for that workman's comp because you didn't.
Oh, wear. Sure. And so what? Are people who live below mountaintop removal communities supposed to just walk around with a respirator on?
Yep. Well, that might be our future if we don't do something soon.
It could be. Kevin, take care.
Take care, Bob.
Bye now. our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Big thanks going out to Henry, who just took us down to $55 to go in fundraising for this evening. I'd like to hope we can hit that mark between now and 9 p.m. 5 at 10, 10 at 5, 2 at 25, 1 at 55. You get the idea. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. By the way, I'm told by Irish Dave that the Flim Flam Man was set and filmed in Cumberland County, North Carolina, right near Fort Bragg. And he says, and that's probably just a coincidence. Coincidence. Sure. And thanks, Isaac, for sending me the pigeon drop scene. It's from over on YouTube. If you've never seen the Flim Flam Man, it's worth the effort. It's got a couple of hokey spots, but it really is. It's a nice little mid to late 60s study of human nature. Hey, welcome to the program.
Take me to the river.
Drop me in the water.
Yeah, Al Green.
Yep.
Great version. By the way, Bob, you know me, I can collect rumors in my old age, you know. There's a rumor that one of our favorite callers from the West Coast, a young lady with two nieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know who I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know it's her birthday?
No.
Well, one of my inside spies gave me the information that it's Sandra's birthday.
Wow. Happy birthday.
Yeah, to her, yes. She's a caller I miss because between you, you guys get going, and then you finish it up with pro football, which, of course, gasses me because my first year of following the Cleveland Browns was 1954 at age 11. And the ability to read that I used to have, you know, I could stare holes through a newspaper, you know. And, of course, Mr. Graham.
Otto.
Yeah, who most people have forgotten. But he was, when I first went to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in probably 69, he was the top quarterback in the history of the game at that point. Of course, he'd been surpassed, too, but.
There's a real roll call to be had in Cleveland football lore. I mean,
well, Paul Brown
himself.
Yeah.
Otto Graham, Lou the Toe Groza,
yep.
Jim Brown.
Dante Lavelli.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Statsky. Who was it? Max Speedy, who quit the Browns and went to Canada. They're both in the Hall of Fame. Bill Willis, middle guard from the old five-man line of the 50s. Yeah, he's in there. And there's been guys went in since then. But, that era of Paul teams were, well, when they won the Eastern Division every year from 50 to through 55, and they won the championship three, I think they split 3-3, I think, in those games. But, you know, it was a fun time to be a football fan. And my mother took me to a parade of the 48 Indians. And, of course, I was 5 years and 10 months old. So, but there's a good history of the Cleveland Indians, which I was trying to think of the name of the shortstop, and I had it, and I lost it. I played shortstop in 1920. Was hit in the head with a ball.
Yeah, and is buried in Cleveland, right?
Yep. Yeah, he's buried at Lakeview, of course, where Garfield Monument is, too. And, a monument to people's money. Cremation, I'll take care of that myself, and if I was still filling Zippos, I might do it quite accidentally. You know, it's one of those things. But you guys were hitting it tonight. But I had to get that news out. I miss our West Coast friend. She has not called in a while. Because the most exciting thing to me is any time I learn something I didn't know after years of reading and studying, when somebody can kick something into my head, that means you're still living when somebody can do it for you.
Right.
And they say, we have some, I thought at first Jim and I were having a little beef over the, because you know me, when I get started on the Civil War thing, and quite honestly, if you look at the development of the the battlefield stuff west of the mountains from the Mississippi to Chattanooga. The South did not. The men fought like devils, but the track record was not what Lee's was as far as who was controlling the battlefield when the thing was over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The Western Union armies were a bunch of outdoors kids, which gave them a kind of an equality with the Southern men, who were outsiders and hunters and shooters and could fight like devils, you know? I mean, what those guys did just, when you think 600,000 deaths out of a population of 30 million, Bob, that's unbelievably unique.
Yeah, that's the kind of, well, there were entire towns whose people did not come back.
Yeah.
Clarksville, Tennessee being one of them.
Okay, I didn't know that, but yeah.
Or I think, you know, only one or two came back, something like that. But yeah, horrible. Horrible.
The losses in that mess. You ever been to Sharpsburg or Antietam, whatever you want to call it?
I have not spent any extended time there. I've seen it, but not been able to stay and wander.
Yeah, I wanted to move there. That was my retirement home. Would have been, if I had my way, would have been Northern Maryland, because it was just, Cumberland, and because I think you were talking about.
Oh yeah, that's beautiful country.
Yeah. It has its points, and of course, there's a really good book on the WPA, and one of the first things they built was Camp David. They put together that piece of work.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there's a really good book on the WPA. In fact, I had forgotten the name of it, and our listeners, our buddies, was able to call him in and tell me what it was. That was quite a while ago when that happened. But I have to get my book machine primed back up and get back on the library track, because that keeps you sane. If nothing else, listening to somebody else. Mr. Storyman, will you tell me one, you know? Because there's some really good stuff. I've had some books put on tape. Hell in a Very Small Place, the Siege of Dien Bien Phu. And Bernard Fall, and he wrote another one called Street Without Joy, which was just excerpts from things he sent to Paris when he was covering the First War. And when you read those, and I was reading the book on Dien Bien Phu when we were involved heavily in Vietnam, and I'm reading this one and saying, what the hell are we doing there? Because as you and I know, the reports coming back from the American War, where there was a lot of bullshit going on over there, the general staffs, a lot of writing.
I think of what happened when Willard Romney's daddy went over there. You know, he was the governor of Michigan, and he was running for president. He was actually out in front of Nixon with the Republican nomination.
Until
he went to Vietnam.
Yeah, and came back and made a speech.
And said he had been brainwashed.
Yeah, you know what it is in politics, Bob. You get up and tell the truth, you're liable to be. Luckily for him, he had sold enough Ramblers, which that was a funny car anyway. The ignition system was very similar.
And he would go on in just a couple of years to give us the AMC Gremlin, wouldn't he?
Yeah, a nice idea as far as the ability to haul crap. But, God, what a... That back window gave me an idea. Well, you could rent it out as a sauna. It had to have been hotter than whatever with all that glass back there.
I just love the way you responded, though, Bill. I said Gremlin, and you went, nice idea, but...
Yeah. I saw plenty of those. My dad had a 59 American for a while, Rambler, and they were a very economical car. They were always pushing the gas mileage on those things. But, you know, as I said, they had a solenoid on the fender side like a Ford did. And there was something else about them that they were buying parts from both Ford and GM to make those things. There's a hustle everywhere you look, Bob. Somebody's got an idea to how to turn a dollar, but... Yeah, I had to pass the word along because we have not heard from Sandra in a while, have we?
Maybe about a week and a half ago.
Oh, because I was.
Yeah, I think you weren't able to listen
back
at the time.
Online yet? Yeah, and I got a problem.
But she was having a fine time on Twitter the other night watching the Broncos take out the Pats.
Oh yeah, doesn't like the Pats.
Well. I think it's what Sandra said. She expected the hoodie to just solve Peyton, but the Pats were just too beat up.
Yeah. You know, he coached here. Belichick coached here in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And he was dropped when they made the move. And a lot of fans here, there was a lot of battling about him, whether he was good or not. But some of us felt that he had some ability and organization, or, you know, because Brown was, you talk about an organizer, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I had the pleasure of going to a Browns training day at the old league park when they used to work out there, and it was a very pleasant experience. I met and shook hands with Paul. That was the second time I met him in my life. And then, of course, Mr. James Brown, Jimmy in this case. That was then, of course, I walked in the locker room, got embarrassed as hell, and left. I said, what happened to you, Bill? You're 5'6". Look at the size of these guys. Holy Jesus. Oh, well, you know, you're born. I didn't know you were as old as you are, Bob.
I'll soon be 51.
And that's the year I had a heart attack, 51. It's a hard living, little bastard, sure. You know. Well, you know, you're up all night Friday, up all night Saturday, get up early Sunday to spend time with the wife and try to be normal. And you get at 9 o'clock, you're hauling a radiator out of a car on Monday, you know, or working on a TV or something for whatever extra dough you could make. I told you, people used to, the old joke was, a guy brought me a TV that was so old that when I turned on the fights, there was two white guys boxing. That's how old it was. That was, of course, believe me, Bob, there were some great fights in the 50s with Robinson, Sugar Ray.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And he was a middleweight, and I don't know whether who he was fighting all the time. Was it Gene Fulmer or somebody? Carmen Basilio. Basilio had enough scar tissue around his eyes to open up a place for where women could take their wrinkles out of their face and put them in his forehead. Because boxing was, I don't know if you watch much of it or watch any repeats of those days. It was brutal. And there was like three nights a week of boxing on television. And I remember the Tefauver hearings. I watched those. My mother was always yanking me around saying, now you learned something from that, Billy. And, I did. I saw MacArthur's old soldier's speech that he made to Congress. Saw that live. And, all it was preparation for what was coming. Because that anti-war stuff was, I was approached to go south and register voters, and the guts went out of me. I said, I don't know if I can do that. I might want to, but there were some people stopping bullets down there. What was the three guys that they found floating in a Mills Creek or something? Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney.
You talking about Philadelphia, Mississippi?
Yep. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, Earth and Dam.
Well, you know, because most music critics, blues critics, will tell you that that's why the best of the Chess, the so-called Chicago period of post-war blues, the best guys there came out of Mississippi.
Oh, sure, out of the Delta.
Yeah, that's where the strongest men came. And, I guess Buddy Guy was from northern Louisiana, but that was no better. Louisiana, of course, brings to me, who was the guy that...
Well, look, you know, nothing, no American art form of which, at least musically, has developed out of a place of opulence.
Nope.
Consider the Carter family coming down out of the mountains of Virginia.
Yeah, bluegrass would always hit me like New Orleans jazz with the
with the
chronic interplay of instruments.
Yeah, and the New Orleans jazz, Dixieland, what have you, that scene was not born out of wealth and riches.
No, the funeral came from the fact that there was a lot of, you know how big lodges were in this country? Belonging to
a lodge. Yeah. There was we had a period of people being big time joiners.
Yeah.
Odd. I think my grandfather was an Odd Fellow and a Knight of Pythias.
Oh yeah, those were two big ones. And of course, there's a lot of things said about the Masons that are not positive. But being a former Catholic, Masonic was cursed and sworn at, basically, by the Catholic leadership. And, of course, the Knights of Columbus.
Right, until they invented the Knights of Columbus.
Yeah, the answer to that one, yeah. The idea of belonging to a group used to mean an awful lot. And in some ways, I hear a lot of folks talking about the isolation factor in today's society or the Internet.
Well, look, I mean, industrial Midwestern towns were noted for having their Polish-American clubs,
yep,
and their Hungarian-American clubs and their Italian-American clubs, and they were points of community for purposes of, well, I mean, they were created community so that people could have sort of a sense of place and a sense of belonging.
Longies.
As opposed to just being cast adrift into the capitalist wonderland of endless labor, endless toil, no pay, and miserable existence.
Well, my first job in the world at age 16, working part-time in a shop making sweaters, in a knitting shop, working on circular knitting machines that were patented around 1906, 1910. This stuff was so old, I'd stand there and look around looking for Charles Dickens to come crawling out of someplace. Because the Industrial Revolution is all you can smell in that place.
Well, see, we forget some of our great writers. I downloaded, and I think it was free, the collected works of Frank Norris. Ever heard of him?
I've heard the name, but I know nothing.
He was a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley. And I learned about him because he is one of the heroes of my fraternity. See, I was a joiner too.
Yep. Well,
and
common, yeah.
And he made his way in the world by exposing noxious, hateful excesses of the height of what Twain called, the Gilded Age.
Yes, I had that book in a collection. Yeah, I read it once quickly.
He was a novelist and a reporter. He only lived to be 32 years old. He wrote The Octopus, A Story of California. He wrote another book called McTeague. And he wrote The Pit.
Was it all heavy anti-industrial?
Oh, yeah. He was a progressive naturalist. In other words, he wrote in his sort of unscathing realism. And everybody, of course, has their flaws, and his was anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Well, people will have... it's funny how some people have things that come out in them, certain... I mean, I get that today from some folks. Well, when these right-wingers start talking about Israel and their current prime minister, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. Are these people morons or just positively inane? Because I remember sitting at my desk in 1960. What year was it? The Arab-Israeli War, where they snuck their planes in low and brought them up into radar range just on time to cook most of the Egyptian Air Force when they were climbing into their cockpits.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then they pulled all their tanks and moved the other way and took the Golan Heights. I mean, it was a great operation. I have to say this. The Israeli army was one tough son of a bitch. It's something you didn't want to mess with. But
they had the best arms in the world.
Yep. Well, yeah, didn't they get them all from us?
Best in the world.
Well, in fact, from what I read, at one point there was more tanks on the Sinai than Hitler had sent into Poland, you know, because armored vehicles had gotten preponderance of everything. There were probably as many Shermans and Pershings on that damn battlefield, and the old story is here's some take some of this old junk. I've seen more Sherman tanks up on pedestals in front of the library and small civic buildings. You know, they had to do something with them. So, here, take these and look at them. Well, I won't keep you, but I did have to get the word out on one of my favorite callers who I have not heard soon enough lately, or often enough. Yes, you guys can get into it pretty good and then finish off a fine intellectual meeting with a talk about professional football. So that's well, always an enjoyable substance.
Well, that's always a delight, simply because that's our moment of shallowness.
Yeah, well, everybody's got to have one. I mean, believe me, I'm so shallow I can walk on water practically. And it's not out of any godlike thing. It's just finding the right amount, low amount of water in my case, and tracking to it. Anyway, you take care of yourself and of course, stay in touch. And thanks for another night of making the old boy think a little bit. I appreciate it.
Oh, always a pleasure. And thank you for everything you bring to the program, Bill.
Well, I can bring
you
in a lot of...
Because you bring a boatload.
Well, I try to bring in a lot of sociological stuff and historic stuff that is just an arrow pointing at the crap that was being done now. This isn't the first time this crap's gone down. I mean, like me, when I moved into a neighborhood that was racially mixed, and hell, there was more white folks in the projects there where I was living. And hell, you get on an electric bus, you know, a trolley bus, and you sat down, and you didn't care who you sat next to. There was no goddamn, well, I can't sit next to this young black man or this old lady because they're dark skinned. And I'll tell you, you get over that shit early, and you try to keep it that way. And you try to meet people before you make any judgment of them. You try to. I mean, there's people from all walks of life that I didn't like too. I mean, let's face it, Bob. There are people who are not really nice, and I don't care what part of the world they're from. And they can be a pain in the ass. But on the other hand, you should actually meet a person and talk to them and get a little idea of what they're thinking and how they feel before you make some kind of half-assed judgment about somebody. Like I told you, when we played football against you guys from West Virginia, there was a lot of fighting going on. And, man, those fellas you didn't want to tangle with, because I was noted for being a dirty fighter because I was small. And what rules, you know? Can anything can happen in this world.
Yeah, you mean root hog or die, tough hide lasts the longest?
Well, I always had something in my pocket that when I snapped my wrist, it had a blade on it. And that was the 50s, man. You couldn't help it. You couldn't, things like the movie Blackboard Jungle and that were jumping out at you.
Yeah.
And what did you learn from, you know? You learned from what you saw. And look at reading Kerouac when I was under 16 was like, that was a very unusual thing to learn about that way. And, of course, Catcher in the Rye, you read that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody did. I think I was 13 when that hit me. And
it's kind of a trinity there. Catcher in the Rye, or Catcher in the Rye, On the Road,
yep.
And Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, you learn a lot from that stuff, and hopefully you keep learning. I'm fighting with tobacco, and I'm learning so do you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's an ugly Jones.
Well, it was a time when I was hanging out with the hippies on Coventry and the yuppies, and every Sunday I'd go up there for breakfast, and I'd pick up a can of chewing tobacco. Not that I liked it, But it burned the hell out of these folks when you're standing there spitting. They look at you like, you dirty son of a... Yeah, well, that's right, folks. What can I tell you? You know, because tobacco was God when I was 13. If you didn't think you were Humphrey Bogart and sucking on that weed, you weren't worth a shit, you know?
Yeah.
It's actually, that's the way it was. The tougher you
Well, had, I saw what did I, what I saw an old Lucky Strike ad the other day. 9 out of 10 surgeons recommend Lucky Strikes.
Yeah,
it's toasted.
When you hear that stuff today, you don't know whether to laugh or throw up, you know? It's one of those things that, well, you can laugh hard enough that maybe you end up throwing up anyhow. Because you know what tobacco's done to the country, what it did to the country. When I was a kid, it was over 50% of this country was using tobacco when I was 10.
Yeah.
A package of food from World War II, or a pack, you know, sea rations?
I've seen pictures the way, yeah.
Yeah, and there was always cigarettes included in it?
Yep.
Yeah, well.
And my father said the chocolate, because they had to reformulate the chocolate so that it could survive in the holds of ships plying the South Pacific. He said it was the worst chocolate that has ever been made by human hands.
I can believe that. And the other thing was that there was an Italian restaurant here in Cleveland owned by a guy named Chef Boyardee.
Oh.
And, of course, now it's all over the market. And I've eaten a few cans of it in my life. And that's what I miss about not cooking is I used to do a slow cooker thing with the sausage from the West Side Market.
Oh.
Sausage and slow cook it for 4 hours with some good bottled sauce.
See, you're talking about food up that way, and you're all of a sudden something just clicked in my mind, and I thought, cabbage rolls.
Yep.
God, do I love cabbage rolls.
Oh yeah, a friend of mine.
With that, with that kind of thin tomatoey sauce that goes with it. Ah.
Oh. A buddy of mine, one of the two guys that's been standing next to me like they're my sons. One is Colin DeSalt, and the other is a guy named Jeff Beam, bass player Jeff, and harmonica player singer Colin. They've been like kids to me. I mean, they've stood up and they've carried me like I was the old man. Because I had one daughter that was given up for adoption by the rich woman who mothered her. And then I lost her to suicide about 6 years ago. I met her when she was 27 and I was 50-something. Came out of the adoption network. You know how they can find the,
mm-hmm.
the blood parents? Yeah, so She was real close to me. My first question to her was, do you read? And she, of course, broke out that she was a fanatic reader. And I said, yeah, well, you're my daughter, all right. Anyhow,
no further inquiry need be made.
Nope, that was all I needed to know. And I have two granddaughters that I never see anymore, but they were shocked to learn that their mother, who had been adopted, of course, had a, you know.
And meanwhile, in the chat room, I just got a note from Waggy saying about the cabbage rolls. My grandmother made those, Bob.
Yep.
Ukrainian in the Cleveland area.
Yeah, that was it. We had some, we still have a couple, a bit of Budapest is over here. I was on the west side of Cleveland, and this stuff was like, what was the veal called? I told myself with the name of the breaded veal.
Oh, the Wiener Schnitzel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, God almighty.
Yeah,
let me go here
Before you do, I'm going to tell you one last thing, and that is this. You know, I was talking with my buddy Bo Webb that I work with in the AIC campaign, and, you know, he spent a lot of his career living and working in Cleveland.
Yep.
And he met the woman who would become his wife of many years, Joanne. He met her when she was tending bar in a bar where you used to play.
I'll be damned. I wonder which one it was.
The Malibu.
Yeah, I did it a few times. But I got to throw out a compliment to the wife of a fella from south of here who goes by the first name that starts with T.
Yes.
His wife brought some soup up here, homemade. And You know, I never realized you could eat and have a psychological orgasm at the same time. This stuff is fantastic.
What kind of soup?
A bean mix.
Mmm.
It had a lot of things in it, probably that I shouldn't eat, but on the other hand, nobody's going to live forever.
No.
It's a better way to go than getting shot at.
And I can think of a lot of things worse than soup. I only asked what kind of soup because I've been on a soup kick lately. I was, talking to Ferg about maybe it's time to make a big pot of really kick-ass chili.
Yeah, you got it, man. Give me that big slow cooker and give me the stuff. And in fact, there's a mix you can buy called Cincinnati chili. You ever have that?
Yes, I have. Like, what is it? Gold Star and what's the other brand?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, Bill, that stuff's a little bit weird to me. I know Cincinnati people just go over the moon for it, but it's sweet Greek. And it's got a bunch of cinnamon in it.
Yeah, it's in Greek in origin. Yes, that's the difference. You hit the flavor right on the head. Because I was playing in Cincinnati one year at a place called the Black Dome, which was interesting because we were there a week between John Mayall one weekend, and we were in the middle between Mayall and somebody else. It was a funny time, Bob. Things were wide open. I went to Detroit to a place called the Grandy Ballroom, which was based on the West Coast ballrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And we stood up there with Eric Clapton and the rest of Cream, just the two bands. And it was an honor. You know, Capitol offered me a contract about 1960-something or other. But I'll tell you what, when I could read it and see the holes in it, like you get to the part where you sign and they told you bend over and sign.
Mm-hmm.
I called him with some questions about how come there's no guarantee of release on this and blah, blah. And that was the last I heard from them. Because
you weren't supposed to have those.
No, you're not supposed to question anything. Sign the contract. Here's your Vaseline. Go enjoy yourself. Anyhow, take care of yourself.
All right, you take care, Bill. Have a good evening.
Good night. And Sandra, happy birthday.
Indeed. Happy birthday. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Onward we go. Lines open, 304-658-3333 if you want to jump in. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Hey, welcome to the program.
How are you this evening?
Reasonably warm, Jim, and hoping to remain that way.
Well, that's a good state in which to remain, that's for sure. As a matter of fact, chili will be a good night on tonight, will be a good thing on tonight.
And see, I like mine blazing with sour cream and onions and, yeah.
Well, mine is much simpler. There are three elements, cumin, basil, and, of course, chili powder.
Well, when I make mine, there's making it just to get some made, and then there's making from scratch. And when I make from scratch, I rehydrate the chili peppers, use a Foley food mill to get
that's okay. I mean,
and come up with a paste that'll bring out a chili paste that'll bring out the sweat on your hairline and
Well, I mean, to each his own. I've never enjoyed eating food like that because I dominate the food. It doesn't dominate me.
Oh no, it doesn't dominate me either. It's just you get that hellacious endorphin rush and man, you're off and going.
Well, whatever. I mean, to each his own. Just a thing about Camp David, that was built originally as by President Roosevelt, and it was called Shangri-La after the book by James Hilton, Lost Horizon.
Right.
And so it's the old movie, not the more recent one, but the old movie of Lost Horizon. Is a real beautiful movie. It really is. It's been cut. It's been so old. I think it came out in 1936. But if you want to see some fabulous Art Deco, you can see it in that movie. It was built in that particular valley there, called Shangri-La.
I'll be darned.
It's just absolutely incredible. I think Ronald Coleman and I can't remember who else was in it, but nonetheless, it was just an incredibly futuristic architecture they had there in Shangri-La, where they had managed to, I guess, escape from the plane wreckage that occurred,
mm-hmm.
and they came through, and there it was. But anyway, in the book, you know, the guy does manage to come back to Shangri-La. And the protagonist of the story. But not to get on that, I've just got part of a letter I also want to share with you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Okay, let me see. All right, I shall always be ready to work for the victory that, of course, and I shall spare no efforts to serve it as long as the fight is fair on both sides and calmly conducted with dignity. In fact, it would not be possible for me to take sides. I've always been in favor of the rapprochement and the spirit of brotherhood, and I shall protest with the same vigor against discrimination, from which side it may come, and against all violence without exception, since I am convinced that violence would be a bad course to take in the future. And I'm going to skip to the end of it, and the signature line is, I beg you to accept, Mr. President, the expression of my highest esteem. Please convey to Mrs. Kennedy my children's kind regards and my own and my very friendly sentiments. And it's signed Josephine Baker.
Wow. Wow. How did you come by that?
Letter to John F. Kennedy.
Huh?
By Martin W. Sandler. But that young lady came from St. Louis and made her way across the Atlantic and took Paris by storm in the 20s and in the 30s.
Yes, she did.
And in the 40s, she sang for our troops. She was fought with the French resistance and was there in her abode when Hitler took over France. And you can imagine how they felt about finding her there.
Oh, yeah.
But nonetheless, she did. And she always wanted to have a family because she couldn't have children of her own. And she adopted 13 children and called them her Rainbow Tribe. She was married to a French band leader. We talked about her before. But nonetheless, she was quite a lady and quite an entertainer and quite an human being. And when she passed away in 1975, she was given a state funeral by the French.
Yeah, I know they gave her the Croix de Guerre.
Yeah, they did. And even though she fell upon hard times, the person who rescued her was Princess Grace of Monaco.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. She absolutely did, absolutely, because she was an incredibly beautiful person in so many ways. In so many ways, she really was. And I've always admired Josephine Baker. So, and in that spirit, I will also offer to Sandra a happy birthday, many happy returns. And I will leave you to other callers.
All right, Jim, have yourself a good evening. And thank you for the memorial there. And thanks for reminding me. I just went and did some reading real quick. And, you know, what an amazing human being.
She certainly was. Good night.
All right, take care, Jim. Bye now. About 20 minutes before the hour. If you want to get in on the tail end of the conversation, this would be the appropriate time to do it. 304-658-3333 on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Okay, I've got a note here from Isaac, birthday song for Sandra, if you don't mind playing it for her, one of her favorites. I hope you're not messing with me, Isaac.
I got a feeling Bill's probably grooving on that, too. No, you were not messing with me, Isaac. Thank you very much. That's awesome. Jimmy McGriff, After Hours. By way of happy birthday, Sandra. Happy birthday, indeed. We are at about 14 minutes before the hour, and we are very near indeed. To finishing out fundraising for the evening. We are $45 away from making that goal. Thanks very much to Ken for his help. And as we wind down the program, just a little, it's nice to always, where possible, it is nice to end on a good note, a pleasant note.
And so it is, since Isaac shared that awesome piece of music just a moment ago. We'll go to Isaac again for something that he tweeted to me as the broadcast was beginning. You know who Dinesh D'Souza is? You recognize the name, don't you? I mean, when you hear the name Dinesh D'Souza, don't you just immediately think hypocritical right-wing asshat? Yeah. I do. This is a guy who's been involved. He worked for Ronnie Reagan. He has been tied up with a whole bunch of nasty right-wing so-called think tanks. American Enterprise Institute, Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was the director behind the 2012 documentary film that bombed called, wait a minute, we've got to do this right, 2016, Obama's America. Ew. And among other, so, and then he worked himself a hustle into getting a little dodge as the president of King's College, which is a wee itsy bitsy nasty little tiny right wing Christianist extremist institution in New York City. And that was a pretty nice gig for Dinesh. Being as how he prided himself on his academic credentials, and being as how he's a staunch supporter of one man and one woe man traditional merge, right? Yeah, he had that gig until it turned out that he had become engaged to a woman while he was still married to his traditionally married woe man wife. Gotta love these guys. So today, apparently, he had a really bad, awful, no good day. Because a federal grand jury in New York City handed down an indictment with his name on it. Who thunk? It turns out he's into dirty politics and God knows what else. Because according to the indictment that was opened today in Manhattan at the federal court there, back in August of 2012, Dinesh D'Souza reimbursed people who had whom he had told to contribute $20,000 to a Senate candidate's campaign. Isn't that charming? These little right-wing jerks running around hauling, voter fraud, voter fraud, ooh, oh my God. The brown people are voting, oh, Jesus, the flag is falling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it turned out he tried to dummy up an election in New York. The candidate in question was not named in the indictment. I mean, that just wouldn't be sporting now, would it? It wouldn't at all fall within the Marcus of Queensbury rules, like punching below the belt. But the Reuters article that Isaac sent to me kind of points a finger in a certain direction, because Dinesh D'Souza despises Kristen Gillibrand, Senator from New York. And in her last re-election campaign, she was challenged by Wendy Long. And it just turns out Wendy Long had gone to Dartmouth and graduated a year before Dinesh did. So, you know, they're like buddies, I guess. Kristen Gillibrand whipped the hide off of Wendy Long. She took 72% of the vote. But along the way, according to this indictment, Dinesh D'Souza allegedly, I'm going to throw that allegedly in there, tried to increase Wendy Long's coffers by getting more people to give more money to her, whom he then reimbursed, which, interestingly, is apparently, who'd have thunk, illegal in the United States. I have no doubt that at some point in time, if he doesn't plead out, this case will go to trial, and it'll wind up at the Supreme Court, where John Roberts or Sammy Alito or Slappy Thomas or, well, you know, the rats. Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. We'll look at the case and go, well, what's illegal about that? You mean you can't do that? It'll be just like a scene out of Catch-22. What do you mean I can't have him shot? Well, Dad. Yeah. Trying to grift up the election process as if the electoral process wasn't nasty enough. Ew. Devin just sent me an email. Yuck! Peroxide for ears now. I know. Just the word, the names Dinesh D'Souza fill one with a sense of loathing and a burning desire to go and shower in bleach. But that's, you know, Republicans being Republicans, right? And by the way, as we wander out of here, from the Department of Closing the Barn Door after the toxic horse has long gone, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, who produced, oh, I just saw the lights blink in here, that would well and truly suck. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board said that it was, deeply troubled by the way that Freedom Industries just a couple of days ago said, oh, by the way, there was another chemical in there we didn't tell you about. I mean, we didn't report the spill in the first place, so you really shouldn't be surprised, but no, really, there was. The Chemical Safety Board also put together the plan that it submitted to Earl Ray Tomlin years ago, who then said, nah, we don't want to do that. That would inconvenience the industry. It was a plan to prevent very much the same kind of spills from happening the disaster that happened with Freedom Industry. And so the U.S. Chemical Safety Board just wants folks to know that they really think it's troubling that it took a couple of weeks before Freedom Industry said, by the way, PPH, yeah, that's in the water, too. In an interview on National Public Radio with Diane Rehm, Daniel Horowitz, who's managing director of the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, said that the tank farm there at Freedom Industries was very old and, quote, designed to a very old standard without leak detection or secondary containment. Because, you see, leak detection and secondary containment, well, those are, if we required those, well, those would be job-killing regulations, and the entire economy of West, by God, Virginia would just collapse. Sons of bitches. Self-made. And, by the way, the Centers for Disease Control added its 2 cents worth. Centers for Disease Control having recently noted that it really, really does think, that was the third power blink, it really does think that, gosh, it would have been nicer if the pregnant ladies could have been warned about the poisonous water sooner. Of course, we have to remember that too
would have killed jobs in West Virginia. Because we're all about the jobs here, even if people have to die so some people can have them. Or get poisoned, or go to the hospital, or have their babies get poisoned, or, you know, chemical burns on the leg. I mean, man, we're trying to run some business here. Will you people quit whining? It's up to you if you want to drink the water. I drink it occasionally myself. How them rotors look under there under the bus, boys? Do they need turned? Yeah. Well, you're staying there under the bus. I just wanted to let you know. Well, thank you, Governor Earl Ray. So it's time to get out of here. Thank you for... Oh, that's the fourth one. I'm not liking this. I really don't want to be without electricity in 0 degrees tonight. Really don't. That's it for Thorn in the Side Thursday. Appalachian Power may be working on another thorn for post-show. Thank you all very much for helping to keep up with paying the bills here. It is much appreciated. It's the only way this continues. We'll close the program $45 away from meeting our fundraising goal for tonight. We'll just tack that on to tomorrow for Friday on the front porch and maybe get that out of the way. Thanks for all of your participation, your calls, your emails. Thank you very much. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. And thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox down in Australia. Have a look at the new design of headonradionetwork.com. I think you'll like it. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, for more than 10 years now. Wow, 12th year for the White Rose, making progressive broadcasting available via the Internet. Thank you, Ben. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org, acheact.org. Thanks very much to Sandy Leon Vest for the conversation we had on PRN this night. I enjoyed it very much. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.